Thank you. As you mentioned, Doug Evans just got stuck in mud this week. Last week, I'm not sure if that was a good or a bad thing yet, but we'll find out later. Once I actually get to catch up with him. I guess we were asked to present on ETF trends within the marketplace and some of the things we use as far as best practices for trading with our clients and advisors, the RIAs, and some of the institutional space. So a little bit on trends of ETFs in the marketplace. Within the U.S., ETF assets at the end of 2009 were almost $800 billion. So it's a significant vehicle right now in the U.S. as far as gathering new assets coming in. There were a little over 850 ETFs at the end of 2009. And as you can see, from 2005 to 2009, we've seen significant growth in the ETF marketplace. If you look at it from a global standpoint, the U.S. has roughly about two-thirds of all ETF assets with $800 billion. The overall global assets are about $1.1 trillion. But if you look outside of the U.S., there's about 1,800 exchange-traded products, and products being ETFs, exchange-traded notes, and other types of ETFs that are out there, or exchange ETPs. Within the U.S., though, the ETF marketplace is really dominated by four sponsors, that being iShares, State Street, PowerShares, and Vanguard. You can see at the end of 2009, those four firms accounted for roughly about 91% of all ETF assets. From a cash flow standpoint, at the end of 2009, those four firms also gathered 75% of all cash flow coming into the products.
This is a clarification question. Can you explain how you get more than 100% of cash flow?
Sure. So in that model, or in the in 2004, it's at more than 109, we are capturing only positive cash flow into the products. So while they were capturing positive, some of the negative numbers didn't really equal out. So it's more of a math thing of taking out some of the cash flow numbers. So what's interesting though is leverage ETFs obviously came into the market in the last 2 years, and they've been a really hot product, a lot of news, a lot of buzz around them. In 2009, leveraged ETFs were 11.5% of all industry cash flow. But what you can see here is something we've noticed once FINRA started to really look at these and express their concern was from the beginning of 2009 through June, before FINRA issued their warnings to advisors, they were capturing roughly about 42% of the industry cash flow. Once FINRA came out with their concerns and started talking to starting issuing warnings to advisors that they're in the place of creating suitability standards, making sure that the products that they're recommending to their clients actually fit the client's need. A lot of firms started to take those warnings and restrict or eliminate the use of leveraged products within the firms. So after the FINRA warnings, you can see that industry cash flow is actually negative. It was outflows in leverage. So a lot of that cash flow that we saw in leveraged products last year was really up until the FINRA warnings. If you look at it from a product standpoint, and we use broad buckets, we use broad-based index ETFs as really anything that's capturing the MSCI emerging markets, maybe a large cap. And then we also have niche, which is really kind of the small cap, maybe subsector type products. If you'd like some kind of detail around what we consider in that bucket, I'd be glad to send it to you later on. But those products, along with leverage, account for roughly about 80% of the products that are out in the U.S. today. You can see from cash flow, 90% of the cash flow is captured, though, by only broad and niche products. So what we tend to see is the single countries, the hot products like the BRICS that are coming out that are really focused on the single countries, as well as the broad-based products, continue to just gather most of the assets. We have some players coming in, kind of running the leverage through the ETF space and even some of the active, but we've yet to see them actually capture significant cash flow in those products. There's a website around ETFs, and they call it the death watch list for ETFs. They kind of predict which ETFs are going to be going out and closing up shop. We have something similar. It's more just factual based. We're not predicting which ones necessarily, but The characteristics of products that have closed, 95% of all ETFs closed were in the market for less than 3 years, and they were unable to capture more than $30 million in assets. Of the products that are out there currently, there are roughly 26% of active trading ETFs right now that fall into this bucket of less than 3 years and less than $30 million. So you could kind of predict that there is a there's a lot of products out there that could close up in the next few years. So we'll hold questions at the end around the marketplace, and I'll transition over to trading tips. These are some of the trading tips we use with our clients. A lot of our clients are essentially mutual fund buyers historically, so when they come to start using ETFs, they're not really single stock buyers. They really don't know the rules around trading. They're used to putting in an order for a mutual fund at 4 o'clock. I get an NAV. The next day, I know how many shares I bought. When it comes to ETFs, it's a little bit of a different animal. And the execution part, the product itself is the same as a mutual fund. It's just how you get in and out of them. And getting in and out of them can be critical to your overall success and your performance that your clients are realizing in the strategy you're running. One of the things we hear a lot about is volume in ETFs, and a lot of advisors use the average daily volume as one of their filters to figure out which ETFs they're going to be using within their complex. While average daily volume is a significant number that people should be aware of, it's not the only number. Average daily volume can give you an idea of whether or not you can get better execution around some of the products you might be trading around the underlying basket of securities, but it doesn't necessarily mean that there's no liquidity in these products. There's a lot of products that trade less than a million shares that have tons of liquidity in them, and I'll talk about that in a minute. One thing we do know is around the ETF itself and average daily volume, once you get to about a million shares a day, you tend to trade at a penny. And once you're around that million share number, you start to see a lot more depth come into the market. You have a lot more liquidity there. It's more a function of there's a lot more traders focused on that. The millions of share numbers, it's the sweet spot where we start to see more high-frequency desks come into those products. And the more volume you build, the more high-frequency desks will start looking at those products as it does fit their models. Under that number, it's a little bit harder for those desks to really trade those products effectively with their models. But as I mentioned, ADV isn't really a true gauge of liquidity in the ETF. There's two functions of liquidity for an ETF. It's the ETF itself that's trading, and something like SPY, which trades 400 million shares a day. In most cases, a large institutional order, you can just trade that in spot. But this is an example of our consumer discretionary ETF. Trades less than 100,000 shares a day. And the thing about ETFs is they're open-ended mutual funds. You can create and redeem liquidity on the fly from a market maker standpoint. And for an order of $50 million in VCR, or consumer discretionary product, when you think of it from a market impact and participation rate of the underlying securities, the most illiquid securities for a $50 million order in VCR is 2% of the average daily volume, which is marine products. So as you can see, if I'm trading a $50 million position in VCR, I'm probably not trading the ETF because it only trades 100,000 shares a day. From a market maker standpoint, I'm probably going to trade the basket and use the basket to create that liquidity, call a sponsor, do a creation, and use those shares to give to my client that's looking to buy those securities. This is just a slide we use with clients. A lot of clients are out there just using market orders. We stress not using market orders because there's a lot of issues there. The market is basically not going to take advantage of you, but there's a possibility that your execution will look very different than what you see as far as spreads in the market. We tell clients we recommend using limit orders because it does provide price protection, and if you do it the right way, if you put the limit orders in at a price that's reasonable for a market maker to trade, they're going to trade that block of securities for you at that limit, even if there's not size shown in the market for it. We also tell them if they have access to a desk, to utilize the desk. The desk has a lot of tools available to them. And Paul's going to probably talk a little bit about his product, but these desks have a lot of smart algos that they can use. They have the ability to do the creation redemption for a large client. They have a lot of tools that the common advisor just putting a market order in or a limit order in, they just don't have access to those tools. And that's really how you find liquidity for large block orders in ETFs. from a best practices standpoint, when you're thinking about buying or selling ETFs, you know, some of the things we warn clients around is when to put your orders in. We say avoid usually the first 15, 20 minutes of market open, because you have securities on the big board that may not even be open yet for trading. Market makers are just going to be using price discovery and pricing those where they think the securities are going to open. Towards the close, market makers start to fall out of the market. They stop trading. If they get a large position, it's very difficult for them to potentially put a hedge on. So they tend to, the last 15 minutes, they tend to just back away from the market. Again, use your desk when you have it. The desk is your best friend when it comes to placing ETF orders. And really avoid using market orders, because, again, market orders, if you put in a large order, if there's not enough size there, and you don't give market makers enough time to react to that order, you're going to end up running through the book, and you could pay $2 or $3 more than what you're seeing on the screen. Some things specifically around international and fixed income. International ETFs are a little bit of a different breed when it comes to ETFs and trading, because when you look at an international ETF like emerging markets, 20% of the emerging markets are open during U.S. hours. So 80% of that portfolio is closed. So the market is basically keying off of what's happening in Europe, what's happening in the U.S. in the morning, to determine where they're going to price the underlying securities in, say, Asia. If you're trading a European ETF, the European ETFs are open until usually around noon. So up until about noon, you can get good prices on European ETFs, probably pretty close to NAV. After 1 o'clock, we tend to see high correlations between an international ETF that's closed for, as far as local markets being closed, and the SP, and SPX. So international products tend to follow the U.S. market after 1 o'clock. When it comes to fixed income, just need to be aware that the bond market isn't always open the same day the stock markets are. They have a couple more holidays than us. So when a bond market is closed, you need to be aware of these securities are not necessarily trading. Market makers are going to be taking a guess at where they think they can execute the next open trading session for those. And then, as a function of premium discount ETFs, one of the things is in evaluating NAV for a fixed income ETF and where it's trading in the market, you need to remember that NAVs are priced off of bid side pricing for bonds. And there's usually an inherent premium to ETFs, because a market maker has to go out and buy on the offer. So there's a cost there to do that, while the mutual fund is pricing at NAV. So there's always some kind of price there. But as you start to get outside of treasuries, the more you have in, say, corporates, the wider the premium tends to be in those products, because they're pricing in a higher spread than corporates. And those products are going to tend to trade at wider premiums to NAV, because they're reflecting the true cost of executing those products. Executing on those bonds.